think I've got it solved. I'm just wondering what's causing it. This has gone on for a lot of years. It's definitely related, definitely 99% related to the microphone, the fan microphone. It's an MC6010 microphone that I've had hooked up to the transceiver. Probably since a year or two ago, I bought it from 96, and probably 88, 89, I think, microphone dropped. pole is that your Kenwood 440 HF rig, when you're on 20, 15, 30 meters, when you're on the higher frequencies, the display goes blank, is one of the complaints. Yet the display does work on 80 meters. And now we know what you've got along those lines. But when it comes to the microphone, every microphone cord, even if it's a stand microphone as well as the handheld microphone, the cord is continuously being flexed. And as such, wires inside and shielding are always slowly breaking down. Just a matter of time before some portion along that cord gets stressed and you lose the shielding or you lose one of the wires. And when you do, the wiring is no longer shielded. It picks up RF energy being coupled back into the audio circuit to do all kinds of crazy things. So by some careful testing technique, by wiggling the wire while speaking to that microphone and looking at it on a dummy load with the right kind of instrumentation, they'll eventually find out which portion of the cord has the intermittency. And you're going to have to cut into the cord. With those slightly older rigs, I'm assuming the Kenwood 440 has been around a while.
Had a serious problem with that with a
ICOM 471, a 450 all-mode rig, which I owned 10 or so years ago, the ICOM 471, a whole production run. They forgot to clean off the rosin. The very active rosin slowly ate itself into the bearings of all the variable capacitors and eventually ate itself into the integrated circuit chips themselves and created all kinds of intermittent. I had to give up on that rig. So if you had the rosin problem on your particular printed circuit board of your 440 rig, as I see it, Paul, the fact that you've carefully cleaned it means that you've made an improvement. You may not have completely solved it. The fact that the rosin was there for some number of years and started creating grief, by your washing away the rosin, you stopped it from making any further grief, but I think some amount of damage has already been done of a quasi-permanent nature, and troubleshooting it could be a little bit on the difficult side. I hope I'm wrong, but that's what I'm a little worried about, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it was difficult. I tried doing that myself. I changed the battery out and everything, you know, that was one of these memory batteries that had to be, either had a soldered type battery, what a deal. But while I was in there, I figured, okay, let me do this, because I read about it, and it looked like it was right, because, you know, I was having those problems that Dennis mentioned. But that's like on all the bands. That was a disaster. I know what he means. So I tried to clean it. I said, you know what? I don't know what damage. This is not that easy yet. And for, I don't know, it was an expense, I think $80 or something. Kenwood did it for me. I mailed it to Virginia, and it came back like a week or so later, maybe 2 weeks later. It worked fine for the next 10 years. Now, this has to do with, I mean, it's a microphone thing, from what I see. I'm just wondering, is it maybe the short that I definitely know I got a short. If I move that wire around my hand, it'll go with the transmit. But I think it's also this RF problem, because they said this microphone was susceptible to that problem. I'm just wondering, my question really is, if it is RF, how am I getting RF? Coming from, you know, I'm transmitting, I'm hitting the antenna tuner button, but I'm not talking into the microphone, I'm touching the microphone. Where is this RF coming from? That's what I'm wondering about. I got antennas outside, they're not in here, coax, RGAU running, everything's running out of the shack. So, back to you, Dick.
Who are we out there? Rich recognized. Yep. What you're chasing down, Paul, is not an easy problem. That microphone cord, to do its job correctly, has to have every one of those wires inside making good contact only to the right thing the wire goes to and not connecting to anything else. The fact that you can squeeze and rotate that wire and have it go into the transmit mode, without a doubt, shows you've got a frayed wire and it's making a short circuit. You're making contact between the wires themselves as if you had pushed the talk button. So the connector on the end of the wire, usually the microphone wire tends to fail very close to a connector on each end, 90-some-odd% of the time. And so you're going to have to rework that connector, take it apart, and redo that wiring. You have no choice. And how can it pick up RF? It turns out that the cord coming out of your rig going to the microphone is RF-wise, a nice long length, even though everything's well shielded. But that signal coming from your antenna, which is only 50 feet away, so to speak, is still pretty strong, and there's a hell of a lot of gain between that microphone and the rest of the radio. Between that microphone and the antenna, there's 120 decibels of gain. So it doesn't take very much feedback to create that grief. And so the shielding of that microphone wiring, let me drop. The shielding of that microphone wiring has got to be in good shape. Each of those individual wires have to be in good shape, touching only what they're supposed to touch and not touching each other. You're going to have to take apart that cord and fix it. Or
the time being, stop using that particular microphone and use another microphone. When it comes to cleaning the rosin off the boards, when the factory does the job correctly, you'd be amazed what they've got to do. That rosin, in order to make good, reliable contacts on the wave solder machine, in other words, 99% of those parts get plugged into that PC board, and the machine does hundreds of individual solder junctions as the printed circuit board is waved through that wave soldering machine. To make sure that all the solder flows in the right positions at the right time, they put a very potent, very active rosin on the PC board for that part of the operation. When the board has been completed through the wave solder machine and cooled off, have to go through three or four consecutive bathing operations. And if they do it correctly, the third or the fourth bath, they have to measure the amount of contaminant that's in that solvent when they do that third or fourth washing process. And they're looking for parts per million of the product no longer being there in the wash water, what I call wash water. It's a wash chemical. It turns out that that rosin is such an active chemical that if any of it, if parts per million are left on the board, it's going to give you grief downrange, because the stuff really is a very active acid. It's going to be eating into the rotary contacts on the variable capacitors, and it's going to be eating into all the transistors and all the integrated circuits. That rosin is active enough, let me drop. That rosin is active enough to crawl down the lead of a well-packaged integrated circuit or transistor. And eventually it crawls down that lead, gets to the actual active die of the transistor or integrated circuit inside, and starts eating to that circuit. It will do that. And so that's exactly the problem I had with that ICOM 471 2-meter of correction 440 all-mode rig. And I went through the process of cleaning it as best I could. I personally replaced all those capacitors, and I could sort of get things back in operation, but it was never really very reliable. I sent it back to ICOM. They did a repair operation. They sent it back to me. It worked for a couple of weeks, and it went back to the failure modes. The conclusion I've come to is that if you've had a rig that contains printed circuit boards that have been damaged by that very active rosin, I think that board is going to be suspect for the rest of its life. I'm not sure it can be recalled to life, if you know what I mean. My experience and your experience is telling me that the life expectancy doesn't sound good. Now, maybe Rich has some experience with the 440. Let's see what he's got to say on this. N2EO, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, N2EO. Well, the 440 came out in the 90s, I believe. And no personal experience with it. I repaired a number of 430s when I was in the servicing business. Am I getting through, Dick?
You're sounding beautiful up to the point where you told us you had repaired a number of 430s, then you suddenly dropped out. So tell us what you said beyond the fact that you repaired a number of 430s. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. In Paul's case, I think the microphone problem and the digital readout problem are related, and the problem is RF feedback, getting RF into the radio. The reason I say that MC60 has a transistorized preamp in the base of the microphone where the hand mic or something else does not. And the readout can blank out with RF feedback. What I would suggest Paul does is put a counterpoise wire off the radio or the tuner, probably a quarter wave wire on the band that's most affected, and see if that helps. Back to that, N2EO.
Okay, you're suspicious that RF being fed back is creating the grief. If I understand correctly, I think Paul is telling us that on 20, 30, and 15 meters, where the display goes blank, I think he's telling us the display is blank even in the receive mode when the rig is not transmitting. Let's see if Paul can confirm that for us. WS2F, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I leave it on Vox all the time. You know, I think now that you're saying 120 dB, it's probably, you know, it's probably as far as the rig is concerned. Right. He's talking about an amplified mic. That's what this has. And in fact,
out of the Vox mode just to be sure that it's not being falsely triggered into transmitting. and use a known good mic that doesn't have shorted wiring. If Eric is listening, I'm getting S9 on the input on 2.5, and obviously a mobile operation. I can tell by the waving of the signal. So somebody's running up and down the expressway and doing as much as he can on the 2.5 frequency. Dennis, I know you had a question, so let's see if we're going to be able to get through with you tonight. NY2HF, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dennis, and the TechNet. NY2HF, K2RIW. Are you there, Dennis? Maybe Dennis is not available right now. Let's go over to the mailbag, John. KC2WGV. Those guys that send you these fantastic requests with their electronic ideas, or what have they asked you to tax our memories this week, John? KC2WGV, K2RIW, the big man.
KC2WGV, very good, Dave. And good evening, and Paul, and everyone on the net. First thing, I'd like to beg for a little more patience from some of the people who have been sending me emails. I've been getting complaints that they're not able to hear some of the responses. So I've told them to please resend the emails, and I will ask them again. They went to the website, and it's just not something they can copy very well on their item. So, okay, let me let it drop. I'll go to the first one. Okay. I have an amateur that's working with 6 and 2 meters, and he's having a problem with his XY plotter and his scanner. They seem to be interfering with it. He's tried a few things, a couple of ferrite rings, things like that, and totally can't eliminate it. Could you give him some other possibilities, things he could try? He's moved them as far as he could, but just can't seem to make a difference. Maybe you could help out there. KC2WGV.
Yeah, let me make sure I understand the question, John. So he's got an XY plotter and a scanner. I'm guessing they might be part of a computer network or, okay, just an RF scanner where he listens to local fire, police, and ambulance, and things like that. And he owns a 6 and 2 meter transmitter. And if I understand correctly, when he's transmitting on 6 and 2 meters, that XY product goes haywire, and the scanning receiver goes haywire, even though he separated them a good distance. Is that approximately the problem so far, John? Back to you, John, K2RIW.
Exactly the problem. The only thing is the scanner is a video scanner, the type you put a piece of paper, sheet of paper in, and scan the image. He's having trouble with that and his XY plotter. It's driving him nuts.
Yeah, the average guy doesn't run a video scanner at the same time he's on the air on 6 or 2 meters. But maybe multiple people in the house are doing things simultaneously. RF interference, radio frequency interference, electromagnetic compatibility, every one of those problems is solvable. However, there are times when the solution is a lot more difficult than you think. In many a situation, you may be getting multiple paths for the interference. In other words, the 110-volt cord that plugs into the wall could be acting as an antenna. In the case of an XY plotter, the USB cable that goes between the computer and the scanner is another antenna. The package itself, maybe it's inside of a plastic package, and it's not well shielded. So in many a situation, you've got 2, 3, and 4 separate paths by which the interference can get in. And one of the rules of thumb of solving a electromagnetic compatibility problem, RF interference problem, let me drop. One of the rules of thumb for people who do that kind of work is the chain is no stronger than the weakest link. By that I mean, if your particular piece of electronics that's being interfered with is getting the interference signal by 3 separate paths at once, and you do a heroic job of curing path number 1 and curing path number two, and you look at the response and you think you've made no progress. You may have made a hell of a lot of progress, but there's one more path that the interfering signal is getting in. It turns out the transmitters really put out a very potent signal. And so if you're within 50 feet of a transmitter, so to speak, certain kinds of electronics are going to suffer grief if they're not bulletproof, so to speak. Now, how do you make a piece of electronics bulletproof? This is the best of all worlds. Your piece of electronics would be inside of a six-sided shielded box where the shielding of the box has a high conductivity on all of the edges, and the box itself is giving you 100 decibels of shielding. And as the signal is going into the box, your 110-volt power cord, your USB command signal, and whatever going into the box are going through feed-through capacitors, which will not allow any RF to get through. I'm describing the ideal world. Obviously, you're going to have to back off from this. That's the ideal world. I do remember, let me drop. I do remember my Heathkit AR3 receiver kit that I built way back in the late 50s. It was inside of a wooden box. It was not a very well-shielded receiver. Heathkit AR3 receiver. That tuned from 30 megacycles to 3, from 3 to 30 megacycles is where that receiver tuned. And I was getting interference when I used it during a kind of transmitter operation. I literally lined the wooden box with tinfoil and properly grounded it and put a bunch of bypass capacitors across the 110-volt line, the speaker leads, and so on. I managed to solve the problem, but once again, the chain being no stronger than the weakest link, if there's any one single path left by which the interfering signal can get in there, you're going to get grief. Let me drop. The one other place where I had a very serious RF interference problem was on the so-called GLB synthesizer. Back in the late 50s, 60s, late 60s, early 70s, every 2-meter rig had a crystal for the receiver frequency and a crystal for the transmitter frequency. So in order to be on 3 different repeaters, you needed 3 sets of crystals, 6 crystals total, each one for a receiver frequency, each one for a transmitter frequency, and a great big rotary dial on the rigs of those days. Along comes Mr. George L. Belkey, who lived in the Buffalo area of New York, and he invented the thing called the GLB synthesizer, which used digital techniques to make believe it was a crystal. And so you set the thumb wheel knobs on this synthesizer. You had one set of knobs where you set the frequency for the transmitter, one set of knobs where you set the frequency for the receiver, and only one crystal inside was required, the so-called frequency reference crystal that ran all that digital frequency synthesizer circuitry. That's the good news. And for normal operation, the GLB synthesizer worked very well. Okay, as time came along, people wanted to start using, people wanted to start using PL tones on their transmitter, on their repeaters, so that your signal would only key up the local repeater and wouldn't key up the repeater that was across the Long Island Sound or across Hudson River into New Jersey. So each individual repeater requires a certain private line frequency, PL tone. 136.5, for instance, is the one that's on this repeater. When you added the circuitry to the GLB synthesizer that gave you PL in code, that circuitry became very RF sensitive and went haywire when it was within the vicinity of a transmitter. As such, I literally had to build a six-sided box. The GLB synthesizer was in a metallic box, but all the edges of the box were not sufficiently contacting each other. I had to put square pieces of aluminum in all of the edges with a whole bunch of screws going through the sheet metal of the box into that square piece of aluminum so that all of the edges of the six-sided box were making contact with each other to act as a good shield. I had to do all that in order to make the synthesizer work correctly with the PL encoding circuitry added to the synthesizer. So, now, for the usual techniques, let me drop it. Yeah. Recognizing, you have to think like a RF wave, so to speak. Make believe you are an RF wave, and you're hitting every piece of metal and every piece of wire both in and out of your piece of electronic. And make believe every single piece of wire is an antenna. And now you've got to study, how do we stop the signal being picked up by a piece of wire as an antenna? How do you stop it from getting inside the box? And bypass capacitors, ferrite the chokes, the wiring wraps through a ferrite choke helps a lot. So it's a combination of shielding, choking, and bypassing. Those are your major methods of attacking radio frequency interference into a piece of electronics. I didn't say it's easy. There are some cases that are really tough. RF susceptibility, every piece of electronics that's manufactured by a company that has high integrity, when they build a piece of handheld or tabletop electronics these days, they have to measure what's called RF susceptibility. And you put it into the right kind of a chamber where you subject the piece of electronics to a particular strength of radio signal. Let me drop it. And that strength of radio signal, to be in a method traceable to the Bureau of Standards, you subject your piece of electronics to some number of volts per meter, 10 volts per meter, 50 volts per meter of signal strength. And once you've got the right kind of a chamber that can generate that kind of a signal of that signal strength, that number of volts per meter, you then sweep that signal frequency from as low as you can think of to as high as you can think of, and measure whether or not you get any response. And when you find a response, you have to find out what is resonating at that frequency and stop it from doing it. So electromagnetic compatibility, EMC, EMI testing, is a pretty expensive process that has to be done on all good pieces of electronics these days, particularly the pieces of electronics that go on a civil airplane, and a much, much tougher set of specs have to be met when that piece of electronics goes on a military airplane. You have to literally try every single combination of transmitter on the airplane and receiver on the airplane and other electronics on the airplane. You have to try every single combination to prove that one does not kill the operation of the other. And so the kind of ground testing that's required in military aircraft, it can go on for many months at times. As I said, it isn't simple. I didn't give you a nice simple answer. There isn't a nice simple answer. But recognizing the mechanisms of interference is part of the first process to know how to attack it. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. And yes, I know, because as you know, I was working with some Faraday cages. And when I had to supply a voltage into the Faraday cage, I had to wind up actually putting another little box, completely shielded box, with the right bypass and decoupling for the power supplies going in. Otherwise, those wires were bringing the signal into the Faraday cage. It can be extremely difficult, but if he's patient and keeps working little by little, nipping at it, he's going to get to it. And it is something that's helpful, but it could take a lot of work. Very good. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one. Okay, I have a gentleman who's mixing signals from different generators, and he has a question. How can he couple the signal generators together? What kind of a network, something he can get out of his junk box if possible, where he will not be paralleling the generators completely, but yet still have enough signal to be able to put multiple signals on one cable? He's looking to put two and three signals onto one coax. Maybe you can give him a hand with that, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
Yeah, there's quite a few ways of doing that. Everything from very simple to quite a bit more complicated. Simply running a BNC T connector, connecting the two signal generators together by a T connector where they join onto one wire. Schematically, it looks ugly. as long as you're using the signal generator for weak signal generation. If your particular signal generator is capable of creating a signal of plus 10 dBm, when you're testing a receiver, and you're testing a receiver at minus 7 dBm, that really means that on the front panel of that signal generator, the signal generator tends to run at very specific power level on the input. On the inside there is a oscillator plus amplifier running at some particular power level, like plus 10 dBm, 10 milliwatts or more, usually. And then, if you want a signal of minus 70 dBm, you take your plus 10 dBm signal, put it through a step attenuator that attenuates by 80 dB, and plus 10 becomes minus 70 in decibels. When you've got that step attenuator at a high attenuation setting, the fact that two signal generators are being mixed together at the T connector, sum up signal number one is going into signal generator number two and vice versa. On paper, it looks ugly. Because the step attenuator is at a high attenuation and all signals coming back get absorbed as well as if they were a dummy load, you can do that and it'll work. Now, if you expect both signal generators to go to maximum power output into the T connector, they're going to interact like crazy. There is no real attenuation of that attenuator anymore. Let me drop. So as long as you're only demanding a weak signal, like testing a receiver, just simply putting them together with T connectors is not as bad as it looks. Calibrating it becomes a little bit more complicated, but it's doable. Now, that's the quick and dirty way, and with certain restrictions, it can work very well. The sophisticated way is a hybrid combiner. There is a circuit called a quadrature hybrid, for instance. It's a 180-degree hybrid. These hybrid devices provide two functions. They allow each of the signal generators to get to the output, and they supply very high isolation between the two signal generators. If I bought a Zinger-type quadrature hybrid made by the, oh, I can't think of the name of the company that makes the Zinger. It'll come to me in a minute. Anyhow, good company that makes this device that's not very expensive, and it will isolate the two signal generators from each other by numbers like 40 decibels of isolation, even though the insertion loss from either signal generator to the common output is only 3 dB. 3 dB of insertion loss, 40 dB of isolation, a good quadrature hybrid in its rated frequency region, which could be as much as an octave, that can do it. That's the sophisticated approach. Now, I've given you the quick and dirty approach. Let me drop. The quick and dirty approach is a bunch of T connectors. The sophisticated approach is a quadrature hybrid, something in between, a simple resistor summing network. The right kind of a network of resistors will allow you to combine the two signals. The resistor network is going to have 50 ohms of impedance on each input connector, 50 ohms of output on the common output connector, and all the signal generator, the two signal generators or more, can be combined correctly with that resistive attenuator network, and a reasonable amount of isolation between the two signal generators can be realized if you have the right layout of those resistors. So a resistive network will do it. That's the good news. It's inexpensive. That's the good news. It's very broadband. That's the good news. The bad news is it's got a lot more insertion loss. A well-designed resistive summer has a minimum of 6 dB of insertion loss. And if you want to sum more signals than two, if you want to sum five signals, I'm not sure the exact number, but it's probably going to have 12 dB of insertion loss. So as long as you're willing to tolerate extra insertion loss, a resistive summing network does a beautiful job. There's a lot more answers to this by ways of coupling coils and what have you, but these are the most used techniques in a good laboratory. Quick and dirty T connectors, quadrature hybrids, and resistor summing networks. There are other ways. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, very good. Yes, I think the resistive network is probably his best although he may be able to buy a hybrid on eBay and use that because he will get the isolation. I didn't realize it was that high, 40 dB. That's excellent. He should have a lot of fun with that. Okay, let me let it drop. I'll go on to this next construction. This is cute. Alrighty, got a young amateur who took a pendulum clock as a 2-foot pendulum, and he put a little neodymium magnet on the pendulum, and he has a reed switch below it, and as it passes by, it closes the switch. He uses that to check the timing of his oscilloscope time base, and he can go through the ranges and see if it works on all the ranges, and he's got a pretty good little system here. What do you think of that, Dick? Dick, you got some comments. KC2 WGB, back to you.
Yeah, that's pretty cute. If I understand correctly, it's a magnetic pickup of some form, which hopefully doesn't create any significant drag on the pendulum. Otherwise, it'll change the timing of the pendulum. And I guess some clocks, the pendulum can swing back and forth in roughly 1 second, or if it's a grandfather clock, maybe it takes a number of seconds. So to check the timing accuracy of a sweep circuit of an oscilloscope in the slow sweep mode, that can work pretty well. The faster sweep mode, you need another technique. The usual built-in timing calibrator for an oscilloscope usually is a square wave generator. Many an oscilloscope will have a square wave generator where the square wave generator makes four or so square waves on the screen, and the wave generator changes its frequency of operation as you change the sweep rate on the oscilloscope. It tracks, if you know what I mean. Tektronix, among other companies, does that. Also, there are circuits that if you Google the word 1 kHz square wave generator, you're going to find quite a number of circuits. Some of them very simple. Let me drop. Some of them very simple RC networks with integrated circuits. Some of them very sophisticated, where they start off with an exact quartz crystal and count down to the desired frequency. Now, those are the ones that are the most accurate, of course. But the circuitry is more elaborate. So when it comes to making a fairly precise signal generator, square wave signal generator, testing its accuracy, listen to the WWV broadcast at 2.5, 5, 10, and 15 megahertz. At various portions of the hour, they transmit a 600 hertz tone and a 1 kilohertz tone, if I remember. 440, I think it's 440 hertz and 600 hertz. International A, as I remember, maybe it's 660. So the tone created by the National Bureau of Standards on their broadcast station can be used as a reference. I'm going to make a joke here. Traceable to Bureau. They are the Bureau. They are the Bureau of Standards. That's what they used to be called. It's now called NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, I think it is. But it used to be called the National Bureau of Standards. So when we talk about traceable to the Bureau, we don't mean the Bureau where you put your socks in it and your underwear. We mean the National Bureau of Standards in the old days. And so if you have any doubt about the frequency accuracy of your standard oscillator that's in your house, whether it be your clock or your square wave generator, there's various ways that you can get back to the NDS and NIST, as it's called these days. And on top of that, let me drop this. There used to be a telephone number you could dial where Ma Bell would give you exactly a 1 kilohertz note over the telephone. I guarantee there are websites you can go to where that site will generate a 1 kilohertz tone, a 10 kilohertz tone, or whatever, and you can play it through your computer. So we have access to lots of good frequency standards these days. A well-designed global positioning satellite receiver is listening to one of the most accurate things in the world, a satellite, in the downlink frequency. And by way of the circuitry that's inside, you can count down the receive frequency to count to a much lower frequency, like one kilohertz, one megahertz, or whatever. And so lots of hams who want to really have their frequency of their transmitter super accurate are starting off with a global positioning satellite receiver, using the right kind of a countdown circuit on that receiver, which in turn does a frequency accuracy improvement function on their crystal oscillator that runs their microwave transmitter. And by doing those kind of techniques, guys on the 10 gigahertz ham band, 10,368 megahertz, those guys with those techniques can be accurate to better than 1 hertz out of 10.3 gigahertz. So that's 10 times 10 to the 9 is the frequency they're transmitting, and they can be better than 1 hertz. So 1 part in 10 to the 10 is definitely achievable in your laboratory, so to speak, by relatively simple techniques if you follow these schematic diagrams the guys have published. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the SIGNAT.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, that sounded like a fun project that he built there. And if, as you realize, if he shortens the pendulum, you know, he can get it to clock at a faster rate. He could also, if his oscilloscope is accurate, he could clock his pendulum rate and set it exactly where it's supposed to be. So I just thought that was fun. That was a nice thing to think of. All right, so let's drop them on to the next one.
I'm going to give you a funny story. One of my ham radio buddies who lived in Connecticut, he's now moved some other place. He was a broadcast engineer, but by way of global positioning satellite receivers and rubidium standards and whatever, he was able to generate extremely accurate frequencies in his home laboratory. The next thing he did was to go on the air, to use his television receiver over the air broadcast and measure the accuracy of the transmitters that were transmitting the television signal to his house, as well as the 15750, the horizontal sweep rate, the vertical sweep rate, the chrominance subcarrier, the 3.579 megahertz carrier that generates the color signal. He was able to compare the frequency accuracy of various television broadcast stations that were within line of sight, so to speak, of his Connecticut location. Thank you. but he's not going to listen to me.